Everywhere else. So everybody is prospering from the gentrification, but we people, low-income blacks, are suffering the most for sacrificing everything. And then you wonder why crime is going up.
African-American residents of the DMV speak out at a United Nations town hall meeting. And in the second half, we talk art and activism with Professor Mark Anthony Neal. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for January 28, 2016. I'm Esther Averam. Well, the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent is here in the DMV and is, as we speak, preparing a preliminary summary of their findings from their visit to the United States, which began last week. Last night, we were at Union Temple Baptist Church in Southeast D.C. as residents from our region gave testimony on issues of criminal justice, economic justice, and cultural rights of people of African descent. And we'll bring you some voices from inside and outside of the town hall and also stop for a side eye on election 2016. Then in the second half, it's our week for arts and activism, and we'll be in conversation with Mark Anthony Neal, professor at Duke University and host of the online hit show Left of Black. So as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with our headlines. Now, as the UN Working Group prepared to meet residents at last night's town hall, an encampment was set up across the street from Union Temple in Southeast D.C. with a tent and banners and tables and literature and petitions by the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. And they had an encampment project out there. And one of the organizers said that Union Temple is just the latest stop for the project.
I'm African by way of Jamaica, and now I reside in New York. And we are here today in D.C. because we are petitioning the United Nations to charge the United States government with crimes of genocide against African, a.k.a. black people, in the United States. We've been following the UN for four different states now. We've been in Jackson, Mississippi, Chicago. Yesterday we were in Harlem, New York. And now we're here in D.C. because we're just, the UN has been in all these states. They haven't told the community about this. So we are here to bring our people back into political life, to bring the attention back, to give our people the political education. And that's how we set up the tents. We're making a statement. We're saying we are braving the freezing cold, you know, sleeping out here for our people.
Where will you go after the day, after this is over?
We're going to be here for 3 days.
Okay.
So we're here tonight, we're going to sleep over in the tents back there, and tomorrow we're going to be out here again, same thing on Friday. Friday, probably half the day on Friday. Okay. So we're going to be here the whole time engaging people. We were on the corner of, what was that, Martin Luther King?
Mm-hmm.
We're on the corner just getting people to sign the petitions we need. We have a petition going, like I said before, we need a million signatures.
How many do you have now?
We have around seven, well, the last time I checked online, we had almost 7,000. It's an online petition and a paper petition. So I don't know, we haven't counted the papers yet, because we've been all these different states, we haven't gotten a chance to.
When people hear this, where can they find the petition online?
Yes, so they could go to AfricansChargeGenocide.org.
Okay.
To sign the petition. They could read up about the campaign and have everything explained to them. We have it all listed out.
Sure.
The United Nations have an 8-point definition of genocide, and that's all listed there. And they could read up and see that all these examples apply to African people in the United States.
We'll have more from inside the town hall later in the show. Also going on right now until 4 p.m. in D.C. is Student Debt Day, a Student Debt Day action put on by Young Invincibles at University of the District of Columbia Union Station site at 801 North Capitol Street, Northeast. Young Invincibles are hosting student debtors from around the country today and providing them with information on student loan repayment programs, how to use their debt story as an advocacy tool, and they're hearing from U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren about the future of student debt reform. The total student debt in this country has surpassed $1.3 trillion and has become the second largest source of debt in the United States. The average college graduate is currently graduating with just under $30,000 of debt, and delinquencies on student debt payments has risen greatly in recent years. So that's today until 4 p.m. at the UDC Union Station site, 801 North Capitol Street. Also, the fight against the invisible killer, radioactive pollution in unsuspected places, is a week of activities happening right now, and delegations of Native Americans from the Great Plains and Southwest are joining other protesters at the EPA beginning at 12:30 p.m. today as part of the Clean Up the Mines campaign. That's a national campaign to clean up thousands of toxic abandoned uranium mines throughout the U.S. that poison the air, land, and water. And this is from a video produced by the Clean Up the Mines campaign.
Irresponsible corporations and negligent government agencies have abandoned thousands of toxic uranium mines throughout the U.S. These hazardous abandoned uranium mines poison our air, land, and water. Currently, no laws require cleanup of these dangerous sites. Together, we can safeguard our health and environment. It's time to clean up the mines. Visit cleanupthemines.org to take action now.
So again, that protest is today at 12:30 p.m. at the EPA at 1200 Pennsylvania Avenue in Northwest D.C. And there may be a panel discussion tonight from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Nipazan Myong Temple at 4800 16th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. And more info is at cleanupthemines.org. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come right back, side eye on the election. Stay with us. Well, now it's time for our weekly politics segment, Side Eye on 2016. We're really getting to the thick of the presidential election season. And, you know, we were actually just playing some Trouble Funk. We'll be playing them all through the show. And, you know, that cut is like drop the bomb. And a lot of people were dropping the bomb in the presidential election. So, Amy, what do you have for me?
Oh, lots of Side Eye. Hi, Esther. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Jamila. We had a bye week last week, and plenty has gone on since then. I mean, it's sort of, you know, there's so much. The GOP is just spinning along. Obviously, Trump threw down on Fox, and tonight we're going to find out how that plays out. But I thought, for my interest, I want to focus in on, the interest of time, I'm going to pinpoint the return of Sarah Palin. The GOP, that's right, the GOP frontrunner, Donald Trump, he actually has picked up quite a spate of amazing endorsements in the last week or so. Everyone from the son of Jerry Falwell, he's going for the evangelicals by picking up an endorsement from the Falwell heir. And also Sheriff Joe Arpaio from Arizona, who... Wow. I guess that's a play for your anti-immigrant folks out west. I think that's a move toward the general. But the Palin endorsement obviously was the biggest, splashiest endorsement. Got quite a bit of press. And, you know, the thing about the former governor of Alaska, former GOP candidate from 2008, you know, she's, you know, shall we say she has a unique relationship with facts. And with the English language, you know, her way of talking is by now the stuff of legend. You know, and that became sort of a meme immediately after her endorsement of Trump last week. Let's take a listen to someone who does a good job of letting us listen to Sarah in an interesting way.
We Americans are struggling. So many of us have lost our jobs at the factory or our reality shows about Alaska. And we've seen our own children targeted by the police for no reason other than they committed some crimes.
All right. So, of course, that is the famous Tina Fey, former head writer and cast member of Saturday Night Live, who instantly jumped back into her Sarah Palin suit. And the sick thing about it is that her parody may as well have just been, you know, it's just sort of hard to make the separation because Palin's original speech endorsing Trump last week was, it may as well have been a parody. It was just remarkable. You know, Faye captures Palin's sort of disturbing mangling of the English language, and her unfortunate combination of sort of pseudo-evangelical Christian ideology and these grizzly mom, you know, so-called grizzly mom wisdoms, right? But really, when you drill down below the funny layer at the surface, you know, the thing about Palin is kind of sinister and unfunny. And a day or two after her endorsement, we got a glimpse of the darker aspects because Palin's, one of her sons, which is not a funny story, had been involved with a domestic violence case. He had been arrested near their home for apparently beating up his girlfriend. And Palin comes out and makes a very public speech, apparently addressing that unfortunate situation. But she pivoted and tried to essentially pin her son's disturbance on Trump. Okay, Palin's son has been in the military. He's a vet. And she gives this really bizarre talk saying that PTSD happens because folks are coming back and they're angry that the president doesn't understand their issues, which was just so surreal. But you see there the cynicism of attempting to hit that note of everything is the president's fault, and furthermore, these veterans who are, many of them are suffering, you know, for a range of reasons, that can be pinned on the president. So obviously that's a huge, I mean, I just, my eyes rolled so far up in my head, I couldn't believe it. But that's what the Trump campaign has now descended to, and, you know, we'll see what tonight brings around this so-called debate or this standoff. Trump is going to go, what? It remains to be seen, but that was my biggest side eye of the week. Sarah Palin, the half-governor, is back on the scene, apparently.
No, I know you were going to go to Jamila, but, you know, I wanted to say in terms of these fake, phony accusations that Ted Cruz also did something this week. He tried to blame President Obama or Obamacare for him not having insurance. And as it turned out, he actually does have insurance, and if he doesn't, it's because they didn't bother to renew.
You're right.
But anyway, that was something else. Like, you know, where did they get this stuff from? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump in.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Mila, what do you got?
Well, you know, Amy, thank you so much for enlightening us. So have I told you lately, you too, Esther, have I told you how much I appreciate you two? I mean, you are fantastic at journalism. You ask questions, you probe. Your arguments hold their shape despite the slings and arrows of misfortune, fate, and the Trump candidacy. I love you so much. And the color blue, true blue, sticky glue, tie my shoe. Damn it, I am speaking Palinese now. You got me doing that, Amy. I'm talking like
it.
The governor or the quit governor. You know what, though, is the cure for Palinitis? Black intelligentsia. So I will get out right now the latest Ta-Nehisi Coates for to cure me of my linguistic woes. We did have a bye week last week, but the last time we chatted, the country got to see some other actual journalism being committed by Chuck Dodd. You might remember he pressed Senator and presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders on his feelings about reparation for slavery. And Sanders said he wants to look to the future and making America more economically just place for those who are here in the present. But Todd didn't let him off. He pressed on to inquire how Sanders would respond to, say, an African-American questioner who challenged the presidential hopeful on pushing for current and future economic equality while not understanding the very real and lasting legacy, economic and otherwise, of enslavement that remains to this day. So here's what Sanders had to say to Chuck Todd in response to that.
That is looking at politics today as a zero-sum approach. And what I am trying to do in this country is to say, you know what? In the last election, 63% of the American people didn't vote. 80% of young people didn't vote in the midterm election. That is why the rich get richer, and that is why billionaires are able to buy elections.
So Ta-Nehisi has really been holding the feet of Sanders to the fire, and he used that interview as so much fodder for his recent writings about the fact that Sanders, as many others, are using class as the marker with which to measure and, well, to mark too often stymied progress of Black American communities and the people therein. So he points out, Ta-Nehisi Coates, that is, he points out that Hillary Clinton is identical, as he sees it, to Sanders and the Democratic platform with this kind of philosophy. Pretty much Coates is arguing that if Sanders is truly the maverick candidate, my Palinese is showing. If Sanders is the exceptional candidate who is farthest left on issues of justice and fairness, the issue of reparations should not cause him to say, Congress won't do it, can't even try. Let us not forget, though, Coates won a National Magazine Award, a MacArthur Genius Award, and a myriad other accolades and prizes for his Atlantic cover story, The Case for Reparations. So this is an issue that Coates is not at all likely to go easy on. So for me, in terms of side eye this week, how about I just give my side eye to the heteropatriarchal white supremacist capitalism that profited, benefited from, and enjoys the generational fruits of the labor of enslaved and oppressed, stolen, and exploited people. I wonder how Sarah Palin would pronounce that.
I don't think she actually would pronounce it, but it would be painful to see her try. But I have to say, Jamila, following up on your last side eye before the bye, those in that Oregon encampment have been arrested, and their spokesman was actually killed after he reportedly brandished a gun at law enforcement. So we'll have to keep an eye on that counter-revolution in a cup. Counter-revolution in a cup. That's what I call it.
Or toddlers who need snacks.
Okay. But thank you, Amy and Jamila.
We'll pour one out for the tarp man.
Oh, my gosh.
Be well.
Okay. Okay, we'll be right back with voices from last night's town hall. We're going to start this thing all right and get back to the UN. We're going to play some more voices from the UN town hall last night at Union Temple Baptist Church. The meeting was with the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. I guess about 200 people were there in the church. We made our way through the snow to the church, and dozens offered testimony on criminal justice, economic justice. And the first voice you'll hear is Skyla Poindexter Moore of Empower DC.
The housing crisis here in D.C. is inhumane, and I've been battling trying to understand what exactly is the U.N.'s position. Like, what can you do? What can you do as far as the United States goes? And I know that you deal with things that happen to people that are inhumane. So the housing crisis in D.C. is inhumane, and our government has purposefully, and I underline purposefully, decimated and destroyed our true affordable low-income housing without replacing it. They don't replace it. Specifically in public housing, housing that is for the low income. And in D.C., that means black people, because we know D.C. has the largest income gap. And so in other places, you have other races that live in public housing, but in D.C., it's 98% black. So our government basically forces us, and our government is our landlord. And a lot of people don't really understand that, but when the government is your landlord, that's a huge deal. So the government, our landlord, has purposefully neglected our homes to the point of neglect and slum conditions. We're forced to live in slum conditions just because we don't have much money. And then after that, the places are deemed distressed. And then we're forced to leave our homes, we're forced to be put out, and then the places are destroyed, demolished, and rebuilt for higher income people. Gentrification, being forced from your home, displacement. And when we say community control, we don't mean just a few 3, 4, 5 sellouts that you get from the community, that you slide them some money and they agree with everything in the government. We need real community control that's going to benefit everybody, not just a select few. So this is highly problematic, this gentrification. It is and has caused black people in D.C. to suffer inhumanely. Like the sister said up front, Tanika, we're just trying to survive, you know, and they're trying to take everything. They're taking everything from us. Black low-income people in D.C. were being sacrificed by our homes. We're having our homes taken, our schools taken, our freedom taken, our lives taken. Everything is taken from us while the city prospers everywhere else. So everybody is prospering from the gentrification, but we people, low-income blacks, are suffering the most. We're sacrificing everything. They're not leaving us anything. And then they wonder why crime is going up. But I'm asking you, you know, to please do whatever you can do to intervene with what's happening here in D.C., specifically with Bury Farms, as Max talked about. That is sacred land. It's historic land. And the city is putting out, it's already had, they put out 200 families already. It's only about 200 families left. Everything is boarded up. They're forcing the people to live like animals. They can't take care of animals more than they take care of people here in D.C. and anywhere else. So we're asking you if you could do some type of investigation, some type of intervention. We've been to everybody. We've been to everybody. But here in D.C., our WAC leadership, I didn't vote for any of those people up there, but they feel like we don't have rights. They feel like we don't matter. Because we're poor and we don't have much money, we don't matter. They look at us like we're a piece of trash on the ground. And we're humans. And you deal with people that are being treated unlike humans. So we're asking you to please make sure that our rights are not violated anymore. We would like community control over the farms, limited equity co-ops, community land trust, something that will actually benefit the residents instead of just displacing us, because that is not the answer. And I hope you can really do something about it. Thank you.
The next person to speak on community control of the land is Michelle Roberts.
Good evening, and thank you for having this forum and gathering. My name is Michelle Robertson. I'm the National Co-Coordinator of the Environmental Justice Health Alliance. I'm based here in Washington, D.C., but our Environmental Justice Health Alliance spans 13 states, and they're primarily grassroots community groups and advocates. As I begin my testimony this evening, I want to say that Flint, Michigan is not the only issue. We have many Flint communities across the United States. More, it was the environmental justice communities like Flint and advocates under the environmental justice movement that pushed the United States government into implementing an executive order 12898 to address federal environmental justice in minority populations and low-income populations. That was implemented in February 1994. Unfortunately, as you heard from the folks before us, this executive order is actually has not been it's not been a tool that has protected our communities. In fact, we have more disparity today than ever. And it is black people than Latino people in that order as it relates to communities who are living fence line to and in vulnerable spaces to our nation's most egregious industrial toxic operations, thereby poisoning, creating genocide, forced migration, involuntary movement, and all of those things to these communities. We are pushing for safer chemicals, safer processes, precautionary measures. We indeed support that of community-based land trust, a system whereby which communities have voice to speak to the industrial operations around them. As we speak right now, a historic community of Mossville, Louisiana, is being forced out of their community against their will in what's called a voluntary buyout that has the most egregious, unjust means ever, thereby leaving them, as we say, landless and communityless again. We have the demographic analysis to present to you for your record and present and also a summation of this testimony. We hope that you can indeed help us as we address the United States government enforcing them and demanding that they change the way in which they regulate the chemicals management system here in this government. Thank you very much, and we look forward to your support.
The next person to come up will be Esther. And there, thank you.
Thank you to the working group for visiting our region. More than 150 years ago, Washington, D.C. was unique in that it was home to a large population of both free and enslaved Afro descendants who were bound together by black codes that enforced discrimination, segregation, and that reinforced slavery. Today, Afro descendants in this region, despite where we sit on the economic scale, are still bound together in a system that continues to deny us in the very areas that the working group is concerned. One, criminal justice. The failed war on drugs has trapped thousands of us in a system of mass privatized incarceration. Police killings of Alonzo Davis, Miriam Carey, Natasha McKenna, Tyrone West, and Freddie Gray are just four examples of where there has been no justice. Economic development. In addition to the burning issues of unemployment and displacement, this region is unique in that the neighboring Prince George's County is the nation's highest income majority black county. And since the 2008 economic collapse, its residents have lost more wealth than families in neighboring majority white suburbs. Nationally, 53% of black wealth was wiped out in the economic crash. In 2001, the Associated Press published a series called Torn from the Land, documenting at least 157 cases where black people were killed or brutalized so their land could be stolen. Today's modern-day black codes still deny basic labor protections to agricultural and domestic workers, and implementation of Obamacare has been manipulated to deny millions of us health care, cultural rights. This loss of wealth, land, and the legacy of Jim Crow has a devastating impact on our ability to retain our cultural wealth under a capitalist system where, according to a recent study, nearly four out of five people who can make a living solely from their art are white.
recommendations. For criminal justice, we need a federal prosecutor solely dedicated to overseeing the criminal investigation of police killings and deaths in police custody and unjust prosecutions. Here in Maryland, we need the so-called Police Officers Bill of Rights repealed. We need laws that make jobs, housing, health care, clean food, and water a human right, and a system for criminal prosecution of people, corporations, and banks whose actions deny these rights or otherwise hurt or kill people. We need Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder arrested and charged for poisoning the people, the majority black city of Flint, and an investigation of not only Flint, but the black communities impacted in Detroit and Benton Harbor. We need reinforcement of the full Voting Rights Act now being used to deny our attempts to vote and these attempts to disenfranchise us. As we fight against the normalization of our murder and brutalization, we need passage of H.R. 40 by Congressman John Conyers and a process to lead reparations for every African-American man, woman, and child, and for our ancestors who lived and died under this oppression. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, and you just heard some voices, including mine, at the end, at last night's town hall, at the meeting with the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. The working group will be giving a summary of their findings tomorrow, and we will bring you news from that program next week. Now, when we come back, Arts and Activism with Mark Anthony Neal. Stay with us. Welcome back to the show, the Go-Go Show today. So the Music and Film Award season is in full swing as well. As the Golden Globes were, I think, on January 10th. The Grammys are coming up in about 2 weeks. And, of course, the Academy Awards happen in about a month. And the Academy Awards continue to draw their share of controversy. And this year, actually, a boycott. I think at least Jada Pinkett Smith, Spike Lee, I think Michael Moore is joining them to boycott the Oscars. And, of course, the Sundance Film Festival is underway. So with me to discuss, I guess, these and other issues of art and culture from the last year and maybe help to give our own not yet named awards is Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African and African-American studies and founding director of the Center for Arts, Digital Culture, and Entrepreneurship at Duke University. He's author of several books, including What the Music Said, Black Popular Music and Black Public Culture, and Soul Babies, Black Popular Culture and the Post-Soul Aesthetic, and also Looking for Leroy, Illegible Black Masculinities. The 10th anniversary edition of Neal's New Black Man was published by Routledge. And also, Neal is co-editor of That's the Joint, the Hip Hop Studies Reader, now in its second edition. Additionally, Neal is host of the video webcast Left of Black, which is produced in collaboration with the John Hope Franklin Center at Duke. You can follow him on Twitter at New Black Man. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Esther. How you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. I'll still say Happy New Year to all the people I haven't seen yet until the end of January. So, Happy New Year.
Then you probably owe me about five Happy New Years.
Oh, I know. I know. It's been too long. That's, you know, old home day today. So, I guess I want to start with this controversy and kind of get it out of the way because I have mixed minds about this annual Oscar controversy. you know, it seems like annually there's some kind of consideration or problem with what the Oscars is doing with blacks in film. And so what's your take on it?
So, you know, I think it's a mistake to simply think about this as just a question about recognition. There's always been apparatuses, institutions within the black community that have conveyed recognition to black artists for what they do, whether it's music or film. You know, it's Snoop Dogg 20 years ago talking about the Soul Train Awards was his Grammy. So we've always had those kinds of structures, right? So it's not just simply about recognition. What it means specifically with the Academy Awards is that very often that recognition is tied to greater access to resources and capital. So if you're Ava DuVernay and you get a nod, it's the difference between making a $5 million film and then suddenly have a $35 million budget. And that's what the critique is about, right? Mm-hmm. The lack of recognition specifically around the Academy Award, you know, limits the access that African-American filmmakers, black filmmakers and actors will have to the kinds of resources that allow them, A, to be able to sustain their careers a little differently, but also to pick and choose better roles and projects.
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was actually curious when I heard that Spike Lee was, you know, joining this boycott, because just a few years ago, I remember him saying that, you know, it's not about the Academy Awards. You know, it's about access. It's about being able to green light your own films, to be able to get your projects done. So maybe he's changed his mind a little bit. I haven't really heard him comment on it, but I was really surprised, because I just heard him say not that long ago that, you know, it's not about the awards. You know, we need to have our own voice and to basically be able to celebrate ourselves. So, go ahead.
You know, Spike has had such a conflicted relationship with the Academy.
Right.
You know, he's an insider outsider, right? He likes to position himself as kind of an outsider in Hollywood, you know, a maverick. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, he does in fact have access to studios in ways that other independent younger filmmakers don't have access to. Mm-hmm. So he's more inside and out, right? It's the same piece around, say, Jada and Will. You know, for whatever critique they might have of Hollywood, they're making that critique as insiders. And I think that's important. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for many other folks who are trying to get access to resources, they're really truly functioning as outsiders to the Hollywood system. Right. Nate Parker is an outsider to the Hollywood system in that regard.
Okay. Nate Parker is, I'm trying to remember his piece. Tell us more about him.
Nate Parker, the young actor who just produced the Nat Turner Story, you know, which was bought out at Sundance for, what, $17 million or something along those lines. So, okay. You know, that's an example of someone who understood that he was an outsider and used Sundance as a way to be able to get some sort of footing into the inside of the industry.
Okay. So for several years, you know that I gave my top 10 like films on seeingblack.com and actually usually duplicated it here on WPFW. But in recent years, I've kind of focused more on documentaries and nonfiction side of the industry. So I thought that I would very quickly put together something for our conversation today, identifying some of the films I really liked last year, and then offer you a chance to talk about some of the films you like, because I know that you had a kind of a short list that you sent me. So I put Ex Machina, and I guess it's kind of an alternative list, because I know that the film's on the Golden Globe and Academy Award list, but Ex Machina was this kind of independent film that told the story of this man who created these artificial intelligence creatures in his house. And he has an employee come visit him at his house, and this employee kind of just meets all these creations of this man. They're all women. And so the story is a lot about technology, but it's also about gender exploitation. I have to actually see the film again, because there's this one scene that it's almost like a blip. You almost don't see it. But there's this a black woman with like no head, you know, and it frightened me so much, and it frightened me in the context of how these creatures were being exploited. But anyway, I put that on my list. And in the other dramas that aren't documentaries are The Big Short and 99 Homes. These are two films that talked about the economic meltdown and all the exploitation around people's homes and people losing their jobs and everything. And actually, The Big Short is a film that's up there in terms of Oscar, you know, consideration. The Revenant, Carol, Room, Spotlight, and also Beast of No Nation. And I think Idris Elba received a nomination, a Golden Globe nomination for Beast of No Nation. But that was a really searing movie about child soldiers in Africa. And I just was really surprised that it didn't get more attention. But at least he got a Golden Globe nomination in that kind of extra category they have. They have a lot of categories for actors. So you know, you have a better chance of getting some type of Golden Globe nomination. And then for the documentaries, some of them we featured on this show, 3.5 minutes about Jordan Davis, and What Happened, Miss Simone, about Nina Simone, and the Black Panthers, Stanley Nelson's documentary, and also Where Will We Invade Next, Michael Moore's it's just coming out here locally, his documentary about kind of like comparing how we treat our people here with how people are treated in Europe in terms of the quality of life. And so that kind of, you know, those films are on my list as far as documentaries and dramas. So I know that you have some that you wanted to riff on. I don't know whether positively or negatively, but what were you looking at, and what did you think about it?
You know, so I tend to go more along the lines of the more popular films, and because I still in fact have school children, half the stuff I see tends to be like childhood stuff.
Right.
You know, so the movie about the little creatures inside the kid's head, you know, was one of the things that I remember, you know, I think it's Inside Out.
That's right.
I remember Emma the most was really a good film. But in terms of stuff that I'm really interested in, you know, Creed was the one that stood out for me. To be able to take this very old franchise, to refresh it, to get the chance to see Coogler and Michael B. Jordan work their magic again, right? You know, this is just generations Denzel and Spike, you know, kind of working together along those lines. You know, it's, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio and the director that he often works with all the time, right? We haven't seen this kind of level of interaction between a Black director and a Black actor in some time, so I think it's important. And I was really surprised that Creed didn't get more nods, because in many ways, you know, it would have been a makeup for the great pairing that Coogler and Jordan did with Fruitvale Station,
right?
You know, which didn't get the recognition that it wanted, and particularly the thing with Coogler and the directorship. You know, Sylvester Stallone regularly, you know, like for 20 years has gotten like the top award for the worst acting performance of the year.
Right.
You know, so how do you give an actor an Academy Award nomination for his performance in Creed, and it's deserved, but not nominate the director who coaxed that performance out of him?
So
that's where you get to kind of disconnect. But the other things for me, you know, Straight Outta Compton, of course, made a lot of noise because it did so well. And the first half of the film is nearly perfect, you know, in terms of talking about the arc of those four young men, talking about the kind of prison industrial slash crack cocaine moment that they're in, the militarization of the police, which you see within the first 5 minutes of the film, which is extraordinary for folks who didn't know what a Batarang was. You got a chance to see it within the first 5 minutes of the film.
Right.
And so it was important that folks could see that a film like this could be successful, had a wide audience. Yeah, it got a little messy at the end and it didn't tell all the stories that it needed to tell.
Right.
But, you know, we'll see what the director's cut looks like, you know, in the context of that. But for me, the better hip-hop film was actually Dope, because it took a kind of nostalgia piece around the 1990s, talked about all those kind of issues. The focal point was this young, you know, African-American, really immigrant, immigrant figure who himself is trying to navigate, you know, Los Angeles in the 1990s, African-American culture and hip-hop culture, but he's also a nerd, right? So he's trying to balance all of these kinds of things in order to have a successful college career. And I thought it was really a film that spoke to both the innocence and also the tragedy of that moment in the 1990s for young African Americans.
Let's actually play the trailer for Dope.
You go to high school.
Oh, there we go.
Think you're going to get into Harvard?
I'm from a poor, crime-filled neighborhood, raised by a single mother, don't know my dad, blah, blah.
It's cliche.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Malcolm Adekambi. I'm a straight-A student with nearly perfect SAT scores.
He probably got like one of those photogenic brains.
You mean photographic memory?
What'd I just say?
I mean, yeah, you said it. Yeah. Reiterating.
I play in a punk band with my friends, and I'm a 90s hip-hop geek.
You gonna say something or just stare at me?
A bad day for most geeks would be being the butt of jokes.
Some brother really needs to invent an app like Waze to avoid all these hood traps.
It is time we started expanding our horizons.
We're not going to a drug dealer's birthday party. But when you live in the bottoms...
Well, I'll go if you go.
A bad day could look like this.
We were dancing, man.
If I let this slide, we got what they call a slippery slope. You know what a slippery slope is?
Dude got anything to do with skiing?
Shut your ass down.
Don't make fly. Do you have what I left in the backpack?
Did he actually say I'll kill you and your friends if you don't get rid of these drugs, or just you? Don't act like you weren't curious, too.
Hey, all we gotta do is find the white people. Go to Coachella, Lollapalooza.
We don't know nothing about drugs. You do.
We need to know if you're gonna help us.
Okay.
Nobody's gonna suspect a thing. We're just geeks doing what geeks do.
I don't wanna go to jail. I wanna go to college.
Ah, slippery slope.
Exactly.
You play with me, my little boy from the hood?
Hey, whoa.
I am the authority in keeping a proper brother to Horatio. So unless you got some boobies.
What? Like, boys don't cry. Remember we were saying that?
I remember that.
Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Malcolm Adekambi.
Can you dig it?
You can call me N-word, and I can't say it.
Technically, you shouldn't be able to say the word. Why can you
okay,
use it?
Okay, because I'm 14% African. Ancestry.com.
Look, just say the damn word. You're my...
It was a reflex.
Wow, that was a trailer from Dope. And I'm glad you mentioned it because that one kind of went under my radar. So it was out last summer. And so tell me about it.
It was, you know, so many wonderful. It was well acted. You have Lenny Kravitz. You know, Zoe Kravitz is one of the actresses in it. And she's stunning in the role. Again, the lead character speaks to, again, and all the kind of, you know, maladies that we associate to being young and black and growing up in the hood, and he transcends them, right? And again, it also speaks to this kind of Afropolitan moment, you know, where we now have first and second generation, you know, African nationals, you know, living in the United States, you know, becoming adapted to African American culture. And in many ways, the film allows you to see the way that, quote unquote, this immigrant, you know, enclave is actually contributing to what we understand. One of the also main character that's played by one of the Rocky rappers, one of the Aesop rappers. You know, he's an interesting figure because while he's a drug dealer, you also see this was someone who was in traditional schooling, who was very smart, but schooling didn't provide the kind of challenges for him. Mm-hmm. Right. So you see his mind working, like the whole piece about the slippery slope, and none of his boys have any idea what he's talking about. And he's using it as a metaphor. But he, you know, the character, young character, realized very early when he's heard him use that metaphor, oh, this isn't your normal everyday kind of thug. Right. This is actually someone who's kind of a thinking man in this regard.
So kind of switching to music, I know I usually allow myself to hear music a lot through, I guess, other people. I'm much closer to films and kind of TV media. And the thing that I keep hearing from you, from music programmers here, and from a number of sources is this album by Kamasi Washington.
Absolutely.
And... we do have a little piece of it we can play, but when I kind of introduce myself to it, you know, on people's, you know, recommendation, I noticed that it had seemed to have like a narrative around some historical narrative, some references to Harriet Tubman, for example, and just a number of things that drew me to it that made me wanted to listen. So why don't you tell me your experience with it?
So, you know, a couple of things about Kamasi Washington. So the album, The Epic, is three CDs, 32 songs, right? So this is a lot of music to kind of get through. And he's part of a collective in Los Angeles called the West Coast Get Down Crew, right? The young musicians working very collaboratively. And Kamasi gets on many people's radars because of Kendrick Lamar. Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, which, of course, with its 11 Grammy Award nominations, all of these things, you know, in some ways that the nominations driven towards Kendrick are a response to the lack of nominations that his previous album, Good Kid, Mad City, should have received. You know, so, you know, Kendrick's been doing this for a little while, but this particular album, it was much more collaborative process. So you have the R&B singer Bilal. You have the producer, Terrace Martin. You have Kamasi Washington. And so for young hip-hop folks who weren't checking jazz at all, Kendrick became an introduction to really hard, straight-ahead, hard-bop, straight-ahead jazz. You know, not the kind of soul jazz, you know, stuff, pop
Naji,
jazz,
not,
the Kenny G stuff. You know, not even folks trying to deliberately do hip-hop in jazz, right? This is straight-ahead, hard-bop stuff. And it was through Kendrick that a younger audience got introduced to Kamasi. And Kamasi, because again, he's working from a very collaborative standpoint, and he talks about some of this in terms of his own background. You know, he first started playing the saxophone, he's about 12 years old, he's listening to these old tapes, the Hank Mobleys and folks like this. You know, when he first starts working as a professional, he goes on tour, you know, playing in the backing band for Snoop. And folks are going, well, you know, what does one thing have to do with the other? And he will talk about the fact that when he listened to Snoop and Snoop's own phrasing as a rapper, it actually influenced the way that he thought about phrasing in terms of his own instrument. Right. Wow. So this is someone who's growing up in L.A. He has access to this, you know, wide array of what is an L.A. hip hop scene. And he was able to translate this into this astounding recording. And, you know, there's a historical piece. You know, one of my favorite songs in the album, probably my favorite song in the album, is a song called Leroy and Lanisha. And when you hear some of the references, which are very Vince Guaraldi-like, you realize that this is his contemporary take on Linus and Lucy, right? So Leroy and Lanisha is, you know, Linus and Lucy updated in the hood, you know, in 2015. And he's just drawing from so many incredible references. It's one of the best jazz stories I think we've heard in a long time.
So I know we have a piece from the album, and I think it's all instrumental, so we may be able to kind of play some of it and then speak over it and while we finish up the show. But yeah, Kamasi Washington. Yeah, so let's see if we can hear a little bit about that from that, and then we'll yeah. So I'm wondering, in terms of the films and the music from last year, I mean, you do so many different things at Duke. I'm wondering if some of the music that you listen to, the films that you see, kind of get incorporated into the lessons for your students and the things that you want to talk to them about in terms of, you know, I think even entrepreneurship.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the good things is that, you know, my signature class here at Duke is a class on the history of hip hop, which I co-teach with the Grammy Award winning producer Ninth Wonder, you know, who's actually based here in North Carolina. We've done six versions of the class. We're doing a sixth version of the class now. And so, you know, one of the things, we'll be screening dope for the class so we can make these kind of broader connections between the sound of 1990s hip hop, what's happening contemporarily, and the kind of continuity in terms of thinking about hip hop. But the, you know, one of the biggest parts of the class, going back to Kendrick Lamar, you know, Kendrick Lamar, the only woman who appears on Kendrick Lamar's album is a young rapper by the name of Rhapsody, who's from Snow Hill, North Carolina. She is, in fact, signed to Ninth Wonder's label, Jamla. And she comes to class at least two or three times a semester. And for the kids in the class last semester, you know, last spring, who were sitting there listening to Pimp a Butterfly and didn't realize that Rhapsody sometimes would be sitting in the back of the room, and suddenly they turn around and they hear her voice on this groundbreaking To Pimp a Butterfly album and realize that they have access there. So, you know, we try to bring as much as we can in terms of what young folks are hearing contemporarily, what they're watching into the classroom space, but at the same time, you know, try to build a kind of continuity between what's happening now and what's happened in the past.
Okay. I have run out of time, Mark, but I thank you for joining me today, and I hope that we can continue this conversation more, you know, monthly, every other month, something, because I really enjoy talking to you about film and music.
That would be great, okay, Esther.
Great. So that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avarim, and I want to give a special thanks to my guests, author and professor Mark Anthony Neal, and my engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. We're looking for volunteers and interns who are interested in working in radio and digital media. Write us at contact@onthegroundshow. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace.